Major Crane calling.
Why you joined the Party of Regents and the Green Party?
We are receiving enough to survive, but not enough to defeat Russians.
But we still have millions of fighting-age men who are not in the war.
We will be just completely destroyed.
If 20% of America was taken over by a foreign enemy, everybody would be in the fight.
I created, I found, and I run the biggest in Ukraine, a network of educational cultural centers, non-governmental centers.
Criticizing the Russians for taking prisoners to the front, we've now approved that ourselves.
I don't want President Zelensky to be our president again after the war. But before the war would finish, he is our president, he is our commander-in-chief, and I would do everything I can to help him to win this war for our country.
Hello, everybody. This is Brian Bonner, host of Ukraine Calling, coming to you from Hromadske Radio Studio on Krashatyk Street. Today's guest is one of the most theatrical, combative, and fierce members of Ukraine's parliament. He was an early entry to Russia's enemies list, and the Kremlin considers him a terrorist, I think, since 2015. He has more recently tried unsuccessfully to get Russian athletes banned from the Summer Olympics in Paris.
Partly successful.
One of the times he spray-painted nine no on the section of the Berlin Wall outside the German embassy in Kiev to protest the German government's stance on elections in Russian-occupied Donbas.
It was long ago, yes. German ambassador made such mistake.
Yes.
After never did.
I remember Ernst Reichel very well. I interviewed him many times. He was once kidnapped in Odessa. We'll have to talk about that. He wore rubber gloves to pace to troll the Russians after the poisoning of the Skripals in the United Kingdom in 2018. He is the son of former Odessa mayor Alexei Kostusiev, 2010 to 2013 party regents. And he made his own political transition from Green Party to Party of Regents to now European Solidarity, led by ex-president Petro Poroshenko. And he has been a major critic of President Volodymyr Zelensky, at least before the full-scale war. Maybe we can talk about how you get along now. And he was a frequent contributor to the Kyiv Post when I was the chief editor. And I appreciate those contributions, and I went back and read over many of them before talking to you. Without further ado, we welcome Alexei Goncharenko to the studio.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with you, Brian, today.
I'm glad I caught you because you do a lot of traveling inside and outside of Ukraine. I want to first talk about Odessa. It's getting the hell bombed out of it, basically. It seems like that. Is Odessa, how is it holding up? And are they going to get sufficient air defenses soon to protect them, your city?
Yeah, it's quite hard in Odessa. It's not so hard like in Kharkiv, for example, but it's definitely harder than in Kiev or in many other cities in western Ukraine. But Odessa is Odessa. We are standing firm. We are standing tall. So, yeah, it's clear that for Putin today, Odessa is the aim number one, I think, in Ukraine. Putin realizes that he can't take Kiev, I think. But the second most strategic city in Ukraine, with all respect to all other cities, is definitely Odessa. Mm-hmm. Because it's like Kyiv is the capital of Ukraine, but Odessa is the capital of the Black Sea. Because it's the biggest city on the Black Sea shore, not just in Ukraine, the biggest city on the Black Sea shore, period. It's the biggest harbors in the Black Sea. It's one of the biggest agricultural harbors of the world, from which food security of the world heavily depends. For Putin to take Odessa, it means so many. It means to cut Ukraine from the Black Sea, which will make our country never sufficiable, you know, and sustainable. It's to connect to already occupied part of Moldova called Transnistria. Right. It's about control over the Black Sea. It's about control over agricultural export. Today, Putin and Russian Empire are one of the biggest players on energy market of the world. If they would take the southern part of Ukraine and Odessa, that would mean that they would become one of the biggest agricultural players of the world, which would give them a fantastic and very dangerous leverage against the whole world. So This is very strategical, so we understand this. Now, thanks to Ukrainian army, Russians are quite far away. They were kicked out in the end of 2022 from the right bank of Dnieper River.
Right.
So also one third of their Black Sea fleet is already destroyed by Ukraine, including missile cruiser Moskva, which is now a submarine, and a lot of other ships joined Moskva on the sea bottom. And because of this, Russia can't conduct any landing operation against Odessa, can't get through on the ground to Odessa, but they can bomb Odessa. What they do?
Do you have any inside information on air defenses? Because it was a big campaign.
If I would have, I would not tell you, because we can't speak about exactly where is the Patriot, where is some other systems. Definitely, we can't speak about this in this way. But definitely, we need more air defense, and protecting of Odessa and Odessa port. It means a lot, not just for 1 million of Odessa people, not just for 40 million Ukrainians, but it means a lot for the whole planet. Because according to estimation of United Nations, 400 million people in the world are dependent from calories from Ukrainian crops, which makes Odessa so important for food security of the world. So Odessa port should be protected in order to save millions of people from starvation, in order to prevent inflation and food prices peaking in the world. So I hope that more will be done by our allies to protect Odessa port from Russian missile and drone attacks.
They're not going to get it, are they? Odessa and the port?
Again, like we were attacked. Sometimes it is intercepted, sometimes not. Okay. We definitely need more air defense.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I'm sure he'd like to go on to Moldova, too, because Moldova is moving west politically.
This year, there will be elections in Moldova, and we already see how Russia tries to influence these elections to intervene in this.
You just came back from the United States, or a while ago, last week?
Yeah.
It was an extended trip. What was your big takeaway there?
Well, the biggest takeaway was the final decision of U.S. Congress on the supplemental. That was very important. That was very painful, all these 6 months of debates. Now we are finished with this. This is very good, and I'm very thankful to U.S. Congress, to U.S. President, to people of the United States of America for all this support. But we need to understand that this support and this supplemental wins us time. It doesn't win the war. In this $61 billion, because like mainly speaking about $61 billion, I just want your listeners to know that from this $61 billion, 28 is of a direct military supply to Ukraine. Everything else is, there is also 28 for direct military supply, plus $8 billion of economical financial support, which is in loan to Ukraine. All other money are either for Pentagon and internal American use, U.S. use, or some humanitarian help, but it's not about Ukraine. So from these 28, part of contracts will be fulfilled up to 2029. And Russian military budget just this year is $113 billion. So you can compare and understand that this is very important. This is big money. And this money are not given to Ukraine, to our hands, and right. We don't need it. That will be given by U.S. weaponry, which will be produced in the United States of America, by creating jobs in the United States of America. And by these, we will just kill enemies of the United States of America, because Russia is saying that they are fighting here in Ukraine, not with Ukraine, but with NATO, with Anglo-Saxons, with the United States, and so on. So that is very good, very important, but it's definitely not enough to finish this war.
Alexei, I know that Ukrainians are reluctant to criticize their allies. So I'll use the words of Americans like Ben Hodges, Kurt Volker, who say the problem is the U.S. policy. The United States has not decided that they want Ukraine to win and are willing to give everything it takes for Ukraine to defeat Russia. Did you sense a shift in attitude towards that policy while you were there?
No, I can't answer like this. I mean, this is a very good question. We are very thankful for all support to Ukraine. And without this support, we would be done already.
Right.
But yes, there is an issue. And it looks like many people in Washington, they want Ukraine to win. But at the same time, they are afraid of Russia to lose.
Right.
And it's quite strange that they have these. And even after 2 years of full-scale invasion and 10 years of war, but it looks like this for me. And this is very big problem for us. Because of this, I think all these hesitations about, oh, HIMARS is no, okay, yes. ATACMS, no, okay, yes. Long-range ATACMS, no, okay, yes. Patriots, no, okay, yes. F-16, and all like this. And it's very frustrating because I joined territorial defense when full-scale invasion started here in Kiev. And I saw everything. I saw the defense of Kiev by my own eyes. And if Ukraine would have in March, April 2022 weaponry that we received after, we would destroy completely Russian invading army and the war would be over 2 years ago. Then it was a moment when we were preparing our fall counteroffensive of 2022. And it was extremely successful, but we didn't have tanks and armor to purchase Russians where they were running away. And because of this, we did not succeed to kick off them completely from Ukrainian territory. We are receiving enough to survive, but not enough to defeat Russians. This is a huge, huge challenge for us. And the problem is that, and I'm telling this, if we would be given even everything we need, but in several years, for example, it would be too late. Because it's not just about weaponry, it's about people. Who will operate this? We're losing people every day, and this is the biggest tragedy and problem of Ukraine.
Exactly, which brings us to a related topic, because many in the military are saying our problem with a shortage of soldiers is almost as severe as the shortage of weapons. And there are critics among the allies and within Ukraine who say that the conscription policy, the mobilization policy, is failing because it's not getting the fighting age men in sufficient numbers to the front lines where they are needed now. We had months-long debate over lowering the conscription age, as we've talked about, from 27 to 25, when most nations, including Russia, have an 18-year-old conscription age. And we also know that there's maybe up to a million fighting-age men abroad, and that's irritating our Polish allies and other allies. And now we've come a situation where after criticizing the Russians for taking prisoners to the front, we've now approved that ourselves. It doesn't look good. Why aren't men signing up in sufficient numbers, and what can be done about that?
Let me start from the last about prisoners, convicted prisoners. It looks like it's the same that Russia did, but it's really not. Russia created from them units, it was Wagner Group, which was used in kind of Strafbat, which means in the times of Second World War, Soviet Union was using convicts also just to attack on the first lines, just to quickly die, but to give the way to others. Yeah, and Russia used the same tactics with Wagner Group. It's not the case here. Ukraine speaking about, we will take some of convicted prisoners to our regular army where they will fight as well as other soldiers. So there is no any specific attitude to them. Their rights will be the same and so on. Secondly, Russia was taking awful people there, cannibals, rapers, rapists, mass murders, and so on. We decided not to take anybody who committed very serious crimes. Also, we will not take those who were high officials and committed, for example, high corruption and so on crimes. Yeah, so it will be just those who committed not very serious crimes. And I think it's absolutely normal that we will use these people if they want, and that will be their voluntary decision to go or not. And why we to date are taking from Ukrainian cities plumbers, journalists, I know, singers, and we can't take thieves or bullies or all people like them. They also have right to defend their country, and we need troops, we need people. So I don't see anything bad in this. But yes, in general, answering your question, we have problem with manpower just because like Russia is four times bigger than us. And don't forget one thing, that Ukraine is losing people, not unlike Russia in this war. Yeah, Russia is losing people in bigger numbers. They don't care about people in this. They're using them as a cannon fodder and so on. But we are losing people unlike them three times every day. We're losing people like them on the front lines. But also, we're losing people in rare because of Russian military missile attacks, drone attacks, so on. Thirdly, even four times. Thirdly, we're missing people, we're losing people because with every day, less people will come back, those who are now externally displaced.
Exactly.
Because they are creating families, they're socializing in new countries and so on. And fourth time, it's demographics. Ukrainians are not born in big numbers now. In 1990, 1 million babies were born in Ukraine. In 2023, 187,000, which is awful demographic catastrophe, which we have today. So for us, people, manpower is a huge issue, and the most important asset, the biggest problem, and so it's clear.
But we still have millions of fighting age men who are not in the war.
First of all, you can't send all fighting age men to the war. Economy should continue. The cities should be run. There should be electricity, water. There should be food, and so on and so on. So you can't take all these people.
But if we lose the war, there's no nation.
Yeah, that's true. But we are not losing this war, fortunately. But also, we can't completely shut up our life in rear.
Okay.
And you can't take all men of fighting age there. Also, don't forget that we have a loss, and people, some of them are not physically fit, some of them are eligible, some of them they are fathers of three and more children, some of them are watching after disabled people, and so on and so on. So we can't take everybody to front lines.
Right, but wouldn't we lose fewer soldiers if, as the military argues, they are exhausted, and you know yourself, when you're exhausted, you start making bad decisions, your effectiveness goes down, you end up getting killed. They end up getting killed because they're in a life and death situation. They're saying we need everybody in the war. We are expecting the West to do everything for Ukraine's victory. And yet Ukrainian society, it seems, and I live here, has not fully engaged in the war, the war of survival.
The estimation should be made in comparison, you know. What do I mean? First of all, I agree with you. I am one of those who were fighting for establishing of terms of service for Ukrainian soldiers. Today, there is no term of service. And those who are fighting for more than 2 years, they don't know when they
endless.
Will come back. It's endless. And this is very bad. It's very demotivating. It also influences mobilization. Because people, when men know that if they will be mobilized, nobody knows when they will come back home, that definitely not helps mobilization at all. So I'm strong supporter of these. I introduced to the parliament such bills. I did my best to push it. Unfortunately, for the moment, with no result, and this is a very big problem. But from another point of view, let us watch it this way: we have in Ukrainian army near 1 million men, and many of them came there voluntarily in early months of Russian full-scale invasion. Are you really sure that in many Western countries, 1 million men would go as volunteers to fight for their country?
If 20% of America was taken over by a foreign enemy, everybody would be in the fight.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not speaking about United States, you know better. But for example, I met with one of, in the Council of Europe, I met with one of ambassadors of European countries to Council of Europe, and she told me, if we would be attacked, we would surrender. And in many European countries, the moods are like this. You should know this.
Well, many European countries would have to because they don't have a defense.
Yeah, that's so they even don't try. Well, that means that 1 million people is a big number who can fight, and we have still possibilities to replenish them. But also it's a question of effectiveness. We're not in the Middle Ages where everything is just calculated by number of people. The most important with what weaponry these people use. Because one man today with FPV drones and very good trained is much more effective than 100 men with Kalashnikovs in their hands. That's nothing. So we need in Ukraine, with our limited manpower, even if we would, you know, also like you are saying, yeah, we need to take more people. Don't forget one thing. We will take 1 million people more. Russia will take 3 million people more, 4 million people more.
Right. They're four times.
They are four times bigger than us. And so whatever we would do, Russia always could take more people to the front line than we can. It's just much more people. So for us, the most important is that these people should have the best weaponry, the best tactics, the best strategy. This is the only way for us.
But even your generals are saying we can have all the weapons we want if there's nobody to shoot them.
Yeah, exactly. So we need both. But again, if we would just, because I'm hearing it not just from you, I'm hearing it from other Western journalists, so experts and so on. But I'm also, okay, you saying Ukraine should mobilize more people. Ukraine is trying to do this.
Right.
But if you, at the same time, if you will continue dragging the feet like it's happening now with the military support, okay, we will take one time more people, second time, then they will finish.
They have to go together.
Then they will finish. That will be the end of the story. And we will be just completely destroyed.
Right. No, I mean, they go together, and the American generals have explained it to me this way, is that American soldiers are less afraid to go to the front because they know they're going to be armed, trained, and put in a big group with a strategy designed not to have casualties. It looks like Ukrainian men are not that confident that they're going to survive the war.
Unfortunately.
But this is like affecting support, because I'm hearing, I'm not sure exactly what your position is, because I'm hearing kind of different things. But remember when the Russians intercepted the phone call from the head of the German Air Force, who was talking about sending Taurus missiles? By the way, they have 600 Taurus missiles. And the general said, we could send 100, we can destroy the Kerch Bridge, all the key sites in Crimea, but it's not going to change the war, because it looks like they don't have the ground troops to follow up. And you talked about that. We ran out of troops to follow up on the successful offensive in 2022. I mean,
no, in 2022 we had enough people. The problem was weaponry.
Okay,
definitely.
All right, but I'm saying the point is, your Western allies are saying you got to fix the manpower problem. Do you agree with them, or you don't?
Yeah,
agree with them?
Definitely. We tried, and we spoke with you. You said it looks bad about convicted prisoners, and I told you we need them.
Right.
And we are doing this. So I'm co-author of this law.
Do we need to double the size?
We don't have weaponry to double the size. Okay. What we will do with them.
All right.
We can take, theoretically we can double the size, but what they will do? We don't have with what to arm them. We don't have ammunition enough for these people we have already today. Right. So
we're looking at maybe 100,000.
Yeah, but we need also to change those who are already 2 years fighting. So
two or 300,000.
Yeah, so that means that we need to change people. So we need hundreds of thousands more people to change those who are already fighting, and also to increase the number. But it's not just about numbers again. We can't just go by numbers. Because yes, we will go just by numbers, we are done. We are finished. We will always lose to Russia in numbers.
You are in a related topic, you touched on it, and I've done a program on it. I'm concerned because we have more than 5 million people living abroad. And as you rightly point out, the longer the war goes on, the less likely they are to come back. And many of them are women of childbearing age and, you know, kids in school and so forth. You chair the committee, the Parliamentary Assembly, Council of Europe on migration, refugees, and
displaced persons.
Exactly. Are we going to get these people back, and how?
People are people. They're not slaves. They will come back if only they will want to come back. And yes, with every day longer the war continues, less people will come back. That's reality. For them to come back, we need to finish the war here, right, first. Secondly, we need to create conditions for them to come back. Because some of them are those who have apartments, houses in Kiev, Odessa, Lviv, and they can come back any moment. Some of them, they had their lives in the occupied territories and where everything is destroyed up to rubbles, Mariupol, Bakhmut, Severodonetsk, and so on. So they will come back if they will know they will have where to live, where to work, where to send their kids to school, and so on. And this is a huge challenge for us. So we definitely need to do all we can to make as much of them as possible, as many of them as possible, to come back. That's definitely. We need to think about this now, but we really can't make much about this today, because the main reason why they're abroad is because of security. And security is still a huge, huge problem. So that's why...
So if we win the war, they'll come back.
Yeah.
Probably.
That's the situation with them. But also, what we need to say, that I think we need to encourage the Western countries also, because it's interesting, Western countries, some of them, they're making really policy by which those who are young and can work, they are welcomed very much because they need workforce, and these people are, I mean, not all of them, but many, many of them.
Many countries are in no hurry to send Ukrainian refugees.
Yeah,
home.
Exactly. But some countries are in hurry to send aged people, disabled people, and so on, people who are not a workforce, you know. So it's also something which shouldn't happen like this. It should be equal attitude to all of them from humanitarian point of view. And also, what I will do, we will, in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, we are preparing a report which will be discussed and I hope adopted in June during a summer part session about Ukrainian displaced persons abroad. And we will also encourage these countries to create the programs to help these people to come back home. I mean, there are even today some of these people would be ready to go back home to take some risks from security and
right.
so on if they would have where to live or at least to start their first months here
right.
in some new place. And if some countries in Europe, they want these people to come back home, they can help to create some programs for these people to help them to come back, to give them money and financial support for the first time. For the first and the last time, to get back home.
To get them home.
That's also an important part. And I hope that we will adopt it, and I hope that some countries will follow this, because this is important.
Right now, there Ukrainians can live with status until March 2025. Are you maybe proposing to not renew it?
No, my proposal is different. We need all this status is temporary. We need to find a long-term solution.
Okay.
Because many of these people, like, if the war will be finished till the March 2025, it's one story. If not, many of these people will not come back. And it means that it's time. They can't be just on this temporary status.
Right.
They will need to receive some permanent status in the countries where they are.
And we're already in the 11th year, and depending on how you count it, obviously, well, that is how we count it. You know, I wanted to ask you about what's changed. You run a network of of Gonchanenko centers across the educational and cultural centers. Yes. One of them is housed at the Kyiv Post on 68 Zhilanska. And I believe you had said, and I've been reading about that, that one of your missions is to get this to be an English-speaking country. Ukrainian first, yes. English second.
Yes.
And, you know, pushing Russia out, Russian out. Is that true? And
yeah, that's true. That's what I believe in. English language, it's the doors to... Yeah, we want to be part of free world, and we want to speak with free world in one language, but also literally, you know, it's English language. So we need more Ukrainians to speak English language. It is important for in general for country, but it's important for them in person. So yes, I created, I found, and I run the biggest in Ukraine, a network of educational cultural centers, non-governmental centers, which are called Gonchanenko centers. We have already operating 31 of them, and tomorrow I will open the 32nd one in Poltava region.
And congratulations. What city?
Biliki. It's a small town.
I know Biliki.
You know,
yes,
Biliki.
Yes.
It's a small town, but it will be open tomorrow.
Is the funding going okay? Are you doing?
Yeah, that is the story with funding is, I think, miraculous and very interesting. So the first centers I started just by myself and my family in my constituency because we wanted this economy, because we believe in education. So I didn't say, but there is English language. Everything is free of charge in our centers.
For whoever comes in.
Whoever comes in, everything is free of charge. The main activity is English language, but not only. We have other languages. We have French, Spanish, Polish, German, yeah. Mandarin, and Turkish, and so on.
Is it volunteer teachers?
Part of teachers are volunteers. Part of them are paid.
Okay.
And we had, for example, English language is mostly paid teachers and always one of the best in the cities and towns where we operate. So how we finance this? First centers, we started by myself, me and my wife. Then we found the first partners, Ukrainian companies. Then we found international partners. For example, one of our partners is Lord Michael Ashcroft, a member of the House of Lords of the United Kingdom and one of the biggest British entrepreneurs. Kyiv Post made a contribution
exactly.
And supported
us. Adnan Kivan.
Yeah, yes, they also did it. And then we have University of Pennsylvania, with which one of eight universities of Ivy League, which made with us and makes with us English language courses. Then we have other. So as you see, we have international, internal financing. We have small financing in small towns. We have big donors who can make big donations. So that is a success story.
And you're going to stay committed to this?
And we don't receive any penny of budget money.
Right.
That is very important.
Is this going to be a long-term mission?
I hope so. We already work. That's because it's a big, big story. I hope that we will continue to show ourselves as a great way to support Ukrainian education and culture. And in this case, I hope this will last for decades.
Right.
We already are in the... we started before full-scale invasion, so we are now in, it soon will be 4 years of this. And when we started from two centers, now we have already 32.
Well, I can only applaud you. I know the 14 years that I led the Kyiv Post, we started newspapers and education. We sent out the weekly paper in English to as many schools as wanted it for free. And it was a great thing. For free, we got donations to pay for the cost. So I applaud you. Do you think we will become an English-speaking nation in our lifetime?
I believe.
Maybe not mine, but yours?
No, I believe. I believe. We already are becoming better and better. More and more people speak
English. No question about it.
Yeah, so I believe that we can do a great job.
Okay, fantastic. How do you get along with Odessa's two feuding power brokers, Mayor Trukhanov and Adnan Kivan, my former boss?
Trukhanov is elected mayor. I should be frank with you. I never voted for him.
Right.
But the majority of citizens voted. It's democracy. people speak, you know, they make their decisions. So, like, I'm not very involved in internal Odessa politics because I'm more on
national. You try to stay national and international.
Yes, I'm national and international stage. So I'm not very much inside Odessa things. But for example, when it was a question of decolonization and the removal of these Russian monuments and things like this, city council was not very quick to do this. So I made a big push on them to finally do this, and they did it after the push. So in this way, speaking about Mr. Adnan Kivan, this is a man whom I respect, who helped us, as I also in our Goncharenko centers,
right.
And who is big businessman in Odessa, but not only, who is one of the biggest investors in Odessa, but it's another story. So he's in business.
Right.
He has never been in politics. I have a big respect to him as a businessman, to investor, and I hope that he will continue to do this big job, and also he will continue to make the social responsibility acts working here in Ukraine.
Oh yeah, I knew him as generous. We had a great relationship until we didn't, and I know how much he loves Odessa. He doesn't like to spend even a night outside of Odessa, so that's good news. I wanted to ask you why you joined the Party of Regions and the Green Party. I mean, because it wasn't really an environmental party.
Brian, it was.
Everybody knew. Well, okay, let's take with the Party of Regions then.
No, let us start with Green Party, because when you said about Green Party, probably you're speaking about Green Party in quite later stages. I joined Green Party in 1999, so many years ago. At that time, that was a great, really...
Environmental party.
We were planting the trees. We were fighting against pollution. And that was good, because... In Ukraine, there was never this green political movement. And we started. Unfortunately, then the party came another way, became like...
It was more, financed by industrialists.
Biggest
polluters.
More Ukrainian-style party. So I finished there. But it was good. I was head of Odessa regional youth organization. And as for a young person at that time, when I joined, I was 18 years old. It was a very nice experience, and I remember it with respect. But speaking about Party of Regions, it's another story. So if I would be asked, would you join again Green Party if I would be back in my 18 years old? I would.
Yeah.
I would. I appreciate this. And if I would be asked, would you join again Party of Regions when I did it... In 2004, I would say I would never do this, definitely, because. But in 2004, when I did it, it was a different party from what it was in 2014. It can be surprising for some of your listeners, but in the program of Party of Regions was said that the main aim of Party of Regions is European integration of Ukraine. And when Yanukovych became president, at first, I'm not speaking now about what was happening in the field of corruption and so on, but in the field of international politics, he was preparing this association agreement, and he really thought it looks like that Ukraine should like balance between Russia and Europe, but moving to Europe. But when Yanukovych in 2013, end of, you know, in the November of 2013, at the final moment, when Ukraine should sign the association agreement with the European Union, he refused to do this, came to Putin, and like completely changed the course of the country to Russia. I immediately said, "I'm
you quit."
Yeah, I immediately said, "I am against
this." But come
this,
on,
and
you, you're a
party.
Smart guy,
yeah.
And frankly,
yeah.
We knew from the start because I was in. I met Yanukovych when he was Donetsk Oblast governor. It was clear.
By the way, I never met him in person.
By the way, oh, really? No. That's interesting. But
I was just on some events where he was present, but not more.
Wasn't it clear to you from the beginning? And if not, when was it clear to you that this is a party filled with corrupt thugs?
That was the problem. But also, okay, you know Ukrainian politics and Ukrainian history. Tell me, were there parties in Ukraine at that time which were not full of corrupt thugs?
Okay.
Unfortunately, I mean, that was the way. I'm not trying again. I told you, for me to be there was a mistake. As I see now, what is Russia? Or what did Yanukovych in the end of his career? So I would never do this again. But taking myself back that time, my idea was this is a big party of which was popular.
It was the biggest boat.
Party, especially in the eastern and southern part of Ukraine, so in my native city. This party was kind of, they represented themselves as kind of, yeah, maybe there are thugs between us, but we know what to do. We're not just blah, blah, blah speakers.
Yeah, I remember. Efficient managers.
Yeah, if we are efficient managers, we can run the country in direction, and we want Ukraine to be part of Europe. And I thought that maybe these guys will do this. This party also, it was easier for me. Oh, I should acknowledge this. That was also kind of, I was looking for an easier ways for me to go to local politics.
Okay, you answered the question.
Yeah, but I would never, if to take time back, I would never do this again. And when party, and when Yanukovych and party showed their face completely, who they are.
You got out.
I got out when Yanukovych was still on Bankova Street as the president, acting president, and I got out and I supported Revolution of Dignity. And so on. So okay.
I can say that with voters, they've always supported you no matter what party, you've been involved in, or not always, but.
Yeah, I mean, I won the elections there. I for the moment, I never lost big elections, but they understood. And even when I just for your understanding, one small thing, in 2012, so 2 years before Revolution of Dignity, when Putin was coming back to the president after this short period of Medvedev, so-called president, I came to national TV, being a member of Party of Regions, and at that time Odessa regional councillor, and I came that Russia starts propaganda war against Ukraine, and next will be tanks. And that was time when Yanukovych tried to be a good friend with Putin and so on. I mean that my position about European integration, about being pro-European, pro-Western, was always
the same.
It's not that I was like anti-Western and then I became like suddenly. It was always the same.
But got it.
But in my head, in some way, I found it that possible that it can be connected with being part of this party, which was a mistake, definitely.
Got it. You still haven't spoken to your father since 2009?
No. Okay. We were not speaking for 15 years.
Is he still in Russia?
No. I think he has never been in Russia.
Okay.
He, for a long time, he was in London. He lived in London.
Okay.
For a long time. Does he live in London now or not? I really don't know.
I'm sorry to bring up painful, but...
No, I mean, it's nothing good, but we have such relationships.
You know, yeah. We had at the Kyiv Post, we printed a lot of political point of views, and you were sharp in your criticism of Zelensky. Is it because of the war that you've stopped criticizing?
Yeah, at the beginning, I completely stopped because I said publicly, and I can repeat it now, I can be, and I should be, I think, and I was in very sharp opposition to President Zelensky. I have been in sharp because I'm still in opposition, but... when the full-scale invasion started, I said that I can't be in opposition to President Zelensky. I can't be in opposition to Commander-in-Chief Zelensky because he's now, first of all, Commander-in-Chief. And now I still have the same attitude. I can acknowledge, and I need to acknowledge, that Zelensky did a great job in the early stages of invasion to become voice of the country, to emphasize people, to emphasize support to Ukraine, and that was great, and he did a great job. But at the same time, I need to say this, he very poorly prepared country for the war, for the invasion. Up to the last moment, he was refusing to accept the fact that invasion would happen. And now, I think from the management point of view, he runs country quite badly. So the management is poor. That's the problem. One of the reasons for this is that he's not a system, you know, he's not a man of system. He's a very emotional man, an artist, an actor, you know, but there is no system working. There are just several people who are making decisions, and there is no, I think he doesn't believe in institutions. This is the huge problem of President Zelensky, and with the time, it has consequences for Ukraine. So,
so we'll do politics after the victory, right?
Yeah, we'll do politics after the victory. Again, I acknowledge what was done good. Unfortunately, many things were not. And if to finish this discussion, I don't want President Zelensky to be our president again after the war. But before the war would finish, he is our president, he is our commander-in-chief, and I would do everything I can to help him to win this war for our country.
I think this is a good place to leave it. Alexei Gonchyrenko, I thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you continue with your great advocacy for Ukraine and its victory on the international stage and national stage.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Brian, and thank you for your long-standing and many years work in Ukraine, for Ukraine, and you really are, you have this pin, our listeners don't see it, but you have this pin on your suit, Ukrainian and American flag, and I think this is how your heart is. You're both American and Ukrainian.
These are my two countries. I want to thank you all. We're out of time. Join us again next week on Hromadske Radio's Ukraine Calling. Watch us on YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts, and on the radio's website. Thank you. This is Brian Bond.